Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions guru Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, deal or no deal, it's crunch time for Brexit. But where is it all heading? Does anybody know? Is it time, though, to batten down the hatches? Or should you be greedy while others are fearful? Also today, the end of the road for the WASPI campaign after losing their landmark case at the High Court. But we do have some good state pension news. Plus, all change at the top as Tesco gets the boots. And rags to riches motors. What are the classics of the future? And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, after 3 long years, it's crunch time for Brexit, and the outcome could go one of 3 ways. Everyone kisses and makes up and we all agree a deal, or we don't. Theoretically, a no deal, though, is legally off the table, but no one seems to have mentioned that to the government. Or we could just kick the can further down the road and get another extension, or 2 or 3. As if this wasn't enough, though, we can add a bit of bad news about the UK economy, some fresh fears over a recession, the stepping up of global trade wars, interest rates potentially on the up, plus, oh no, not another one, is another election on the cards. So, with all that in mind, Simon, it's good that you keep your clear head while others around them are losing theirs. So, how likely are all these outcomes that I've mentioned?
Whilst trying to leave the politics of Brexit out of this as much as possible, if possible, or trying to be fair and therefore equally scathing to all sides, I think is probably the best policy when discussing Brexit. I should say it's very lucky that we have all those MPs back in Parliament, because it's really good to see all the really good work that they've been doing over the last couple of weeks, rather than just coming back and shouting at each other and showing themselves up. Because I think that there was the risk that that could have happened. And it's really nice to see, you know, people working across party, being constructive and really trying to get this thing sorted. So well done. Well done to our MPs is what I'd like to say. Aside from that, we did have the magical unicorn that is Boris Johnson's potential deal waved in front of our face this week. And it's very difficult to work out how much of a chance there is of getting this deal before October the 31st.
What's different about it?
Oh, it doesn't include the backstop. It includes a new variation on the backstop, which involves some customs checks, Ireland being within effectively within a regulatory union, Northern Ireland, and Ireland within a regulatory union, but there's a customs border. I don't know. It's a bit murky. I don't really quite get all of it.
But the problem appears
to be that there are going to be customs checks. Now, I think that the issue here is that there have to be customs checks because Northern Ireland is part of the UK, and when we leave the EU, there will be a border with the EU. And seeing as the EU insist on there not being an open border there, there's going to have to be some form of border. And the alternative to what's being offered in the deal scenario is a no-deal scenario where there would have to be a border. But obviously, there's a very difficult question surrounding Ireland and the peace process. Yeah. It's a bit murky, and I don't want to get too much into it. It does look a little bit at the moment as if the EU and the Irish are basically telling us that there is no way we can leave the EU without hiving off part of our country, which is a bit awkward. So the other option would be a unified Ireland. Now, I'm of Irish heritage and I have a lot of sympathy for that. However, there's an awful lot of people living in Northern Ireland who don't have a lot of sympathy for that. So we seem to find ourselves at a bit of an impasse, but that's what's being said to us.
Right.
Now, what we're led to want to believe is that behind the scenes, actually, there's lots more to this than this impasse. And actually, people are talking and this is the way forward. And this is Boris Johnson's broad landing zone. And the broad landing zone is going to get narrower and narrower and narrower until, like a buccaneering fighter jet pilot, he lands Brexit down onto the runway on October the 30th. And then he steps out to the adoring cheers of the nation. And we move on to a premiership of renewal and hope and bringing people back together. I believe that's the narrative that's being spun. Certainly on his side. It's not the narrative that's being spun on the EU side or the narrative that's being spun from the opposition in this country, be that the Labour opposition, which has been campaigning for an election for years and then doesn't want an election, or the Lib Dems, who are just simply going to revoke Brexit. So leaving all of that of it, right? So
we've got
the deal, okay, which I may have made sound like it's unlikely to happen. And even if everybody does agree on this, there appears to be a very large weight of opinion that's conveniently being ignored at the moment, that it would be very unlikely we'd actually manage to get this thing through by October the 31st anyway. Then there's no deal. Now, theoretically, no deal can't happen because we've passed a law against it. Mm. But we find ourselves in the weird position of the government maintaining that it doesn't have to comply with the law, as if it's someone getting off a parking ticket. So, I mean, who knows? I guess that's probably bluster. I guess that's probably bluster from their part.
Yeah, perhaps.
You know, I guess they're probably going to have to comply with the law. I'm guessing just taking us out with no deal, with the law being passed against it, is going to be, I don't know, not a good look. Chapter 47, not a good look. Chapter 46 with proroguing Parliament, and not a good look. Chapters 1 to 45 came before that. And then there's the chance of an extension, which is what we're meant to be asking for, rather than having no deal. And if our buccaneering fighter pilot doesn't land his plane on the very narrow runway, we ask for an extension. Who knows how long the extension lasts? An extension isn't guaranteed, of course, because the EU have to agree to the extension. I must admit, if I was the EU, I'd be very tempted to turn it down. But that would be a turn up for the books, wouldn't it, after all this? But an extension is being talked about being most likely to something like January the 31st or something like that. I would say I think January the 31st is unlikely, because going on previous form, what they would do is extend it to the beginning or the end of some form of school holiday, just to try and cripple the travel industry a little bit more, because that's what we've been repeatedly doing so far. So there you go. That's the broad outline. Now, amongst all of this, which everybody kind of knows anyway, is the question of what on earth does this mean for your money?
Yes. Well, that's always very difficult, given the fact that we have absolutely no idea really what's going on. So as much as Simon's just outlined there, Tanya, how would these three Brexit options affect our finances? Do we have any clearer knowledge about this?
As far as I see it, all of the three scenarios lead to the same thing, in effect, which is more political and economic uncertainty. Obviously, a deal would be the best in terms of providing a bit of certainty and clarity. But even then, it's just the first phase over, and they've still got to get on to what people have described as the hard part of sorting out the future relationship. And if this part was really bad, the next part is going to be really awful too, and come with loads more uncertainty. And at the same time, we've been getting bad economic news. Our service sector data was really bad this week, and it came after quite gloomy manufacturing and construction news as well. But even more worrying than what the UK economic data was what's coming out of the US. Their manufacturing data was the worst in 10 years. And when I say 10 years, going back to June 2009, and I think we all remember like how we were all just knocked sideways by the financial crisis. It was fairly shortly after that. And even the US services sector data was the worst in 3 years. So given that the US is really regarded as the engine of world growth, if that is starting to pack up, things are going to look pretty bleak here. And our economic data is, you know, possibly overshadowed by what's looming in the US. So I just think in all those three scenarios, more uncertainty, possibly economic problems, not even coming from us, from elsewhere too.
Good grief, we're a cheery bunch, aren't we, today? Is there really anything that you can do, sort of financially speaking, as an individual? I mean, there's not a lot we can do about the general country, politics, economy. But in terms of savings, investments, mortgages, what should we be looking at?
Well, so I think arguably you could say that if we've learnt one thing over the last year, right? So going back to a year ago, when it was about a year ago when people started really getting worried about this no deal scenario. Do you remember we had the Chequers scenario, and then that was like, no, that's not acceptable. And what we've learned over that year, I think there was quite a broad belief after the Brexit vote, and for a period of time after that, running to about a year and a half ago, that if you were of a kind of Remain-y persuasion, so you weren't ideologically committed to Brexit, then kicking the can down the road might be the best possible solution. And if we just kept kicking the can far enough down the road, then it might not really happen. Mm-hmm. We might either end up never leaving or leaving in some form of very soft Brexit that looked exactly like being in the EU and so therefore represented no form of shock. Kicking the can down the road has not worked particularly well. In fact, it's just made things much, much worse. If you think the British are good at kicking the can down the road, unfortunately, we are negotiating with the kings of... They are the current reigning champions of the can-kicking championship. They have won title after title in the EU, and they're still kicking the can down the road of the Eurozone debt crisis almost a decade later. And that hasn't worked particularly well either. It's the uncertainty that is the issue here. So we just keep getting bouts and bouts and bouts of it, and it's sapping confidence. So eventually it has started to sap consumer confidence. Amazingly, people are still spending quite a bit of money, and also their wages are going up at a fair clip, 4% at the most recent measure. However, if you look beyond that to some of the stuff that's going on the high street, and I don't just mean the shops, what I mean, interestingly, is the restaurants and the cafes. And you've got the big chains, which you can blame some of that on private equity and expanding too far and loading up with debt. But go beyond that and walk around your local high street, and you're seeing more restaurants closing, you're seeing more cafes closing. Now, maybe that was the tail end of a restaurant and cafe boom and, you know, things move in cycles. But it's an indication that people are spending less money. Banks and building societies are super keen to lend out money on mortgages. People are not super keen to borrow it. We've seen credit card borrowing has actually fallen, amazingly. I mean, the amount of new borrowing we take out every month, the amount of debt that we owe is continuing to rise. But there are all these little signs that things aren't quite as good as they could be, and people are holding back. And then if you look at the business world, businesses are holding back. They're investing a bit of money, but they're not investing that much money because they're going, well, we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see. We've got this pot of money here that we could invest to expand our business, but let's not do that now. Let's just wait and see what happens. And with every time that we kick the can down the road, the wait and see approach moves on a little bit further. And we also move that little bit further through the economic cycle. So we're not seeing the benefits that we should be seeing when the economy was doing well. So kicking the can down the road isn't really working. And also, it doesn't really work for people because, for example, look at the place where it most obviously affects people. Only affects them in a little way because, realistically, it doesn't eat that much of your cash. Mm-hmm. But holiday spending money, the exchange rate. Sod's law. We saw the back-to-school bounce in the pound. Everybody comes back from their summer holidays, the kids go back to school, and all of a sudden, it looks a bit more likely that like we might get a deal and the pound goes up.
Conspiracy against
parents,
isn't it, Simon?
It is, yeah, literally. And we saw the same scenario at Easter. During the Easter holidays, the pound collapsed while people were on holiday. And it's a very good indication of the uncertainty and of what's going on. So I think if you take the three scenarios, probably just kicking the can down the road is going to be the worst option. No deal is obviously going to be a bad option in terms of a short, sharp shock. We don't know how bad that short, sharp shock might be. It might be really bad. It might not actually be as bad as we think. Mm-hmm. We have the intriguing scenario of our MPs back in Parliament demanding that the secret plans be unveiled. Sometimes secret disaster emergency plans are a secret for a reason, though. I mean, who knows, you know. But then we also then have the deal scenario. And the deal scenario is everybody expects that if we get a deal, there'll just suddenly be this bounce. And everyone will go, woohoo, let's move on with our lives. I'm going to buy a house. I'm going to buy a car. I'm going to do this. The stock market's going to go up and all those other things. That might not happen.
What?
So you could get the scenario where you get the deal and everyone just, it's a bit of a damp squib and everyone's a bit disappointed. So you don't know. But what you can do is you can protect yourself against the bad things that you think might happen. So if you think that this is going to suddenly lead banks to have much less money and suddenly rein in their mortgage lending, and you've got a mortgage that is up for renewal, go and find a new mortgage now. Mortgage rates are super cheap. Go and lock in now. You can normally lock into a remortgage deal for about 6 months in advance. You don't even have to take it. Some of them you don't even have to pay the fees until you actually take the money. Mm-hmm. Find one of those. It's a free option, okay? If interest rates don't go up, your quid's in. savings rates, they are falling at the moment. That is not directly related to Brexit. They're coming down because interest rate expectations are coming down. All the global recession fears that Tanya talked about, government bond rates have collapsed. There's a mortgage price war going on, so lenders' net interest margins are being shrunk. So firstly, make sure that your savings are in the best possible rate-paying account rather than your bank or building society's legacy account that's paying you 0.05%. Secondly, the better rates can be found perhaps for fixing your money, but you might want to be wary about fixing it for too long. And thirdly, if you've got a big pot of cash built up, including your rainy day fund, and then a bit on top of that, maybe you could try investing some of it to get a little bit better return. You don't have to invest all of your money, you know, just invest 20% of it and then see how it goes with that 20%. And if you like it, you can invest some more. And if you don't like it, then you only invested 20% of your money. In terms of investing, that's a difficult one because, you know, things could literally go either way. We could get this bounce. There is this expectation that the UK stock market will rise because everybody's shunning buying UK companies that are UK focused. But then also people have been buying UK companies that are overseas focused, the big FTSE guns, because they earn lots of money overseas and the pound has fallen and that massages their profits. So you could see a scenario where the pound goes up and the FTSE big guns sink. But you need to remember that the UK stock market only represents a very small portion of the world stock market. And so you don't want to be only invested in the UK anyway. And so there's things you can do to try and build into it. And if you are going on holiday at half term, maybe think about buying your holiday money now, because if there's more volatility between now and then, if it suddenly looks likely that no deal's actually going to happen, you can expect the pound to sink. Yeah. And seeing as it is the school holidays, and that's what's happened every other time there's been some school holidays for the past year, maybe it would be a good idea.
And if you do any of these things, you're going to have to get your skates on, though, aren't you? Because we don't, in theory, have a lot of time to do it. Anything to add to that, Tanya?
Well, on the savings front, it's always a good idea to have a rainy day fund. I would seriously consider having a slightly bigger rainy day fund. I would certainly be thinking, if I had 3 months of salary put away, that 6 months of salary put away. On investments, the experts always say the same thing in a time of crisis, and they said exactly the same thing this week when we had a day of real stock market carnage. It went down 3% in a day, which is quite rare. They always say stay invested, review your investments, look for opportunities, but basically stay calm. With mortgages, Simon and I have debated this in the past. I think it might be a good idea to fix, but in terms of how long you fix for, that is always a vexed question. I personally only ever fix for 2 years at a time.
We're seeing a lot of longer deals, really long deals, aren't we, at the moment? You think?
I know, and the good advice is always to fix for a really long time, but I can't see more than 2 years in the future. I mean, at the moment, we can't see more than a month in the future.
Yeah.
But even when things are on a pretty even keel, I can't see what's going to go on with interest rates for more than 2 years ahead. I can kind of guess for the next year, and I can make an educated guess for the second year. But after that, I don't know. And even though it probably costs me a bit more, maybe, I've got the insurance that if I want to move or things have changed in a dramatic way in terms of interest rates, I've only got to put up with it for 2 years. And I know Simon disagrees with this and thinks you should fix for longer, but that is the way I've always approached it, and I think that I will stick with my tried and tested approach during troubled times rather than Simon, please try and change my mind.
Well, I guess what you have to look at is most people completely underestimate the amount of time they're going to live in a property, so they move in and they think, oh, maybe we might move in 2 or 3 years. They don't. Statistically, they don't. If you have lived in a property for a while, then you think that you might move, then that's a different story, because paying your way out of a mortgage can be expensive. You could take it with you, but you've got to get that lender to agree to the mortgage on the new property. And then if you want to borrow more money, you have to borrow with that lender, and they might not offer the best rates and so on and so on. But I think, A, 2 years goes very quickly. B, if you're doing two-year fixes, you're usually paying fees, and those you will pay one set of fees when you first take out the first one, one set of fees when you take out the second one, and then you'll be halfway through that second one and nearly onto your third set of fees by the time your five-year fix finishes. And also you have to look at, where do you think interest rates are going to be in 2 years' time? Are they going to be lower or higher than they are now? Now, I think probably there's a decent argument at the moment. They might actually be lower. It might be recession time. But in recession time, banks are less keen to lend. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have lots of equity in your property, then that's when you need to think about protecting yourself more, because what caught people out in the financial crisis was the fact that they expected to be able to remortgage every 2 years. So they were taking these cheap deals every 2 years, and then all of a sudden the banks and building societies pulled up the ladders behind themselves, started worrying about house prices started falling. That creates a vicious circle. And so they were much less happy to lend to people. So all of a sudden mortgage rates shot up. But also, if you had a small amount of equity, 5% or less than 10%, you suddenly found it very hard to remortgage. Whereas if you had, you know, 30, 40% of equity in your property, then you didn't need to worry about it. So those are the things to think about, I think. And if a mortgage broker recommends a two-year fix to you, always ask them why they're recommending the two-year fix, and try to work out whether it's because it's the best deal for you or whether it's because they want to... best deal for them because they get your business back in 2 years' exactly. time.
Has that persuaded you, Tanya?
It has and it hasn't. It's probably the case that I need to think about more than just interest rates a couple of years ahead. And I do take on board what you're saying about fees. What I do is I always add the admin fee and divide by however months it is. And then so I've got clear visibility about how much I'm going to be paying a month, including that. It's never been so horrible in terms of the size of it that it's put me off doing that. I've got another year to go, so I don't have to make an immediate decision.
Yeah, and I think the thing to bear in mind is that, like, firstly, although I've spent 15 years worrying about mortgages, I'm not a mortgage broker, so I'm not qualified to give anybody advice. And secondly, you're talking to a man who's got a tracker mortgage.
Touché. I'm really sorry to have to do this, but I do want to ask about both Labour, and we spoke about that magical time when we're not speaking about Brexit anymore. We can dream. But both Labour and Conservative have come out and said that they're going to open the chequebook, Simon, and they're going to smash the cash. They're going to remake the country for the better, Trump-esque, they're gonna make Britain great again.
I've got my hat on order.
I was about to say, we're all going to be wearing our baseball caps with it on. No, we're not. Is an election on the cards, and how likely is it that we are going to get this kind of spending thing? I mean, who can say that? We've just spent the last 20 minutes talking about how we have no idea what's going to happen in the next month.
I think an election certainly is on the cards, if only because the Prime Minister of the time has tried to get one repeatedly. I mean, we've seen the bizarre scenario of the Prime Minister trying to eject himself and his government from office, and the opposition saying no, after having spent the last 3 years. Literally, the first thing Jeremy Corbyn said every time he was asked a question for 3 years was, we need a general election. And then he gets offered one, he's like, oh, it's a trap. I'm not taking a general election.
Which that sound, by the way, was
hilarious.
Simon smacking his forehead.
Yeah.
That's so, about where we're all at, Simon.
It's a risky strategy. The government needs one because as part of Boris Johnson's hold my beer while I become Prime Minister strategy... he not only has managed to lose, but what is it, his first 7 votes in Parliament? Yeah. Has he won a vote yet?
No.
Don't
think so.
He's also ejected about 20-odd MPs, many of them long-standing, and managed to sort of tear up the agreement with the DUP to a certain extent, although that looks a little bit like it might be back on now. So he's got a majority of minus a lot. So it'd be very difficult for his government to get things through. So he needs an election because he needs a majority. But that would obviously be on the basis that he would win the election. Mm. Labour aren't polling particularly well, but they could still win. You know, you would be surprised. Lots of surprising things have happened in the past. The problem is the Remain vote is split between Labour, whose Brexit position... I mean, if you think that the government's position on Brexit was have your cake and eat it, Labour's position was... lay out an entire buffet and eat it. And the Lib Dems, who have basically come up with the just revoke Brexit, full stop, don't even have another vote policy, which appeals to quite a lot of people. So it could really go either way. And there's this expectation that the sort of people versus the establishment line is going to work really well for Boris Johnson, and that if he gets a deal, then he could campaign and say, well, I did it, I got Brexit, and that would take all the votes off the Brexit party. There's a part of me that wonders whether the worst possible scenario for Boris Johnson is that he does get a Brexit deal, takes us out of the EU on the 31st of October, and then fights an election. Because a lot of the votes that he would be picking up would be from the just get Brexit done line of thinking. And if Brexit is already done, those people have no reason to necessarily vote for him. And if Brexit is already done, then the Remain vote no longer is split so much between Labour and the Lib Dems. And so actually you could find him emerging victorious from the plane that he has landed on that tiny runway and then being ejected from office.
Is it Take My Breath Away, Berlin?
It's, in Top Gun.
Yes.
Yes.
You've been bugging me ever since you've talked about...
Okay, right, I'm going to go off a complete tangent
here. Do it,
here.
Simon.
Have you seen the Top Gun 2 trailer?
Yes.
Isn't it amazing? And do you know Tom Cruise is flying that plane? Tom Cruise flies the plane. One of the conditions of Tom Cruise doing Top Gun 2 was that he did his own stunts, including flying the plane. In Boris Johnson's mind, that's
Boris?
Him. That's him. In Boris Johnson's mind, that's him. I'm not sure it's going to pan out that way.
So, yes, we are
going to have an election, and it could go either way. And we could either have the most socialist government that we've had in ages.
Yeah.
We could either have the Tories back in, but a very different looking Tory party to the one that we've had for the last 10 years, because the message other than get Brexit done at the party conference was of this idea of renewal. They're going to spend the money, they're going to open the checkbooks, they're going to basically ditch austerity, and they're going to chuck a load more money also at things that benefit people further down the ladder. Or maybe there's a parallel universe where we get a Lib Dem government, majority government, but I'm not sure what happens then.
Or Boris Johnson shooting in his fighter jet. I'm thinking more zip wire and waving the British flag or a white flag, either way.
Yeah, that's a bit more Boris, isn't it, than Maverick.
Yeah.
If there is a recession and that this economic data is as bad as it looks, then it may be that they have to stimulate the economy anyway. So it might end up being well-timed. It's not the Osborne approach where he did austerity in the teeth of recession. It's a much more Keynesian approach to spend money when times are hard. Mm. But it may, almost by coincidence, come at a good time in the economic cycle. I think they would have to borrow to afford it, though. So that might get us into deeper trouble down the line.
And there I was thinking you're going to end on a positive, and then you took us down deep. That's all right. We are going to move on to a magical land where we're not going to talk about Brexit now. And on to, though, another rather long-running issue that looks to have come to some sort of resolution, although it's not a universally popular one. Now, this is the row over the rising of women's state pension age in line with men to 66. Now, equality is, fair to say, not the problem. The problem comes from the short notice for millions of women who were born in the 1950s, and they say that this has totally thrown their retirement plans into turmoil. They haven't got enough time to sort themselves out. So a group of people got together, a group of women, took the landmark case against the government to the High Court. What happened?
It wasn't actually the WASPI campaign that took it. It was another group called Back to 60. Mm. What the WASPI campaign has always said is, yes, we believe in equality. The state pension age does need to be equalised. What they've objected to are two big problems with it, really. It was speeded up. It was speeded up quite dramatically, actually, by George Osborne in 2011. And basically the women's rises and the subsequent rise for both men and women were both speeded up and happening in quick succession for women, which is why it's particularly bad for them. And at the same time, they really are very unhappy about the lack of communication. And our colleagues on Money Mail had an investigation into the kind of advertising that the government did to raise awareness among women that the state pension age was rising. To say it was dismal is an absolute understatement. We revisited it yesterday because we were writing about the outcome of this court case. How the government thought in the early 2000s that an advert where two dogs were talking to each other would appeal to elderly women, I do not know. Yeah. It's bizarre. And quite frankly, offensive. Another one involved a monopoly board, which didn't even mention state pensions. It was something like "Don't leave it to chance" or something like that. Maybe they won creative awards for that advertising, but it certainly didn't get the message across. So on both those counts, this is one of the reasons that the women have been so upset, that and and the financial hardship many of them are suffering, which is really serious. Waiting 6 years for a state pension when you might have retired or be in ill health, or even if you want to work, can't get a job. Yeah. Between the age of 60 and 66, which is quite possible if you're a woman of that age, that you just, you know, you can't find work. It's a very serious matter.
Well, you wouldn't have factored that into your planning, would you? You would have, no. If you think you're going to retire at 60, you would have planned to retire at 60.
Yes.
What was specifically the argument in the High Court against...
The Back to 60 group was really arguing a slightly different case. I mean, obviously, they're all upset about the same thing.
Yeah.
But they were arguing that the government decision-making over the years had been at fault, and that the policy making had been discriminatory against women. I think that a lot of people feel that because women were often discriminated, I mean, we're going back decades here, that they were discriminated against in the workplace. They sometimes were forced out of a job if they got pregnant in those days, that they were not on a level playing field anyway with men when it came to building up a pension. And so already having paltry savings, and the pension gap between men and women who are retiring now is really terrible. Whenever you see figures, it can be as much as 60% in some surveys. So they're disadvantaged in terms of how much they might have built up privately anyway, and then they're faced with this massive leap. So they were really, a judicial review is really looking at how the government came to its decision, and that's what was the crux of this particular case. There's lots of complaints piled up from the WASPI supporters.
Yeah.
Well, both supporters of both groups, I assume, and they've all been on hold while the judicial review was going on. But when they come to look at those, I think they're going to be looking far more at the sort of the administration of it, which might go back to the communications and so on. I don't know,
right.
But we'll see.
So the campaign is not over, even if they don't take this particular decision further. I assume they can appeal it.
They might appeal. I don't know if Back to 60 has said either way about what they're going to do on that
but
front.
In terms of the whole argument, it's not over.
No, because there's always complaints in the system and they're going to have to be dealt with. We'll have to see what happens there.
Meanwhile, we did have some good state pension news for those in receipt, and it's all down to the triple lock. It could rise by 4% next April. Firstly, what is the triple lock? Remind us.
It's the rise in the state pension every year is decided by whatever is the highest of average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%, which is a bit of an arbitrary number that they have put in there. And the reason that it might go up by 4%, it's not definite yet, but it's looking very likely, is because that's average earnings, and that's looking like it's going to be the highest. Inflation's a lot lower, but unless the September figure for inflation, which we'll get in the middle of October, is quite a lot better, then it looks like it's going to be the 4%. The thing about the triple lock is it's very politically popular, and people like the certainty of it. Whoever came up with the name the triple lock, it was a really good slogan, but they've kind of backed themselves into a corner, because the only way out of it is to replace it with things that sound worse, like a double lock, which doesn't sound as good. We've already talked about how an election is very likely. I mean, there might even be more than one election if they can't thrash it out the first time. I don't think any of the main parties are going to risk dropping the triple lock. So even if it is 4%, which will be a really nice hefty sum for pensioners, I can't see politically that people are going to get so upset about it that they drop the triple lock policy as a result.
So specifically, give us some maths, some numbers. What are people going to be receiving?
The 4% would be an extra £351 a year. As a component of that, it would be about £200 above inflation, if it was set at the inflation level, £168.60 at the moment. It looks like it would go up to £175 plus. If it was on the inflation level, it would be about £171 a week. So it looks like it will have quite a significant jump.
Okay, we're going to move on from this. It's not just football, Simon, that you get a managerial merry-go-round. We got something of that this week in the retail sector, actually. Dave Lewis Tesco Fame announced he was stepping away from the supermarket giant after 5 years at the helm, in probably one of the greatest understatements. He said that when he arrived, Tesco was in a difficult place. So what was that difficult place? What has he done? Why is he stepping down? And what challenges await his successor, former Boots man Ken Murphy? And I mean Boots as in the Boots the pharmacy, not he just runs around wearing boots, right?
He may wear boots.
He might do. But let's go back to Dave. So this in a difficult place, where was Tesco at when Drastic Dave came on the scene?
Yes, Drastic Dave, so called, not because of the job culls and cuts that he has made whilst he's been at Tesco, of which there have been many, but because he used to wield the knife at Unilever. And he will be replaced by Ken from Boots. We're not sure whether Ken from Boots has a nickname. So anyway, Dave came in, and I guess you could say he was given a hospital pass. Tesco wasn't in a great place. It had expanded relentlessly in the at the tail end of the Terry Leahy years. They then had Philip Clark come in, who was not a particularly great boss. He was not universally popular around Tesco and had a bit of a sort of... Well, the talk was that he was very much, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and had a closed circle around him, didn't want to listen to things. The various offshoots, I mean, you've got to remember at the point, in fact, when Phil Clark took over, the end of the Terry Leahy years, Tesco was basically just trying to take over the world. Every morning there seemed to be news that Tesco was getting into something else. So some of the things that Tesco got into, for opening furniture shops, I think it was going to open a car dealership at one point and then canned that idea. It was going to sell holidays. The bank actually has been very successful. That's another thing. But it was getting into all kinds of things. It bought Dobby's Garden Centres. It bought Giraffe, the slightly strange food chain. It opened a coffee shop, Harrison Hall, which it opened in conjunction with someone else. And that was its idea to basically start up a Costa or Starbucks contender. So it was spreading itself very, very thinly. And the one thing that it had ignored was the stuff that everybody knows Tesco for, going into the shop and buying some food. And there was complaints that
it's a big old mess, I remember it.
A big old mess.
Messy.
A big old mess, but also the food quality had dipped. Yeah. And you'd go in there and it'd be a bit of a muddle. They were very much not picking up, although they have been very famous for knowing lots about their customers with the data, with the club card and everything else like that. You'd go into Tesco's, like the one that's local to me, okay? So, and they would look at the Tesco that's local to me and they would go, deprived area. Right. OK. But it's not. It's in North London. It might be officially a deprived area, but it's also full of young professionals who, when they go into that Tesco, they will spend the money on some nice food, on a nice bottle of wine, some nice bread, all that kind of stuff. It had none of those things. Yeah, it really slipped. I think the great test of a supermarket is you go in there, you don't know what you want to have for dinner. You walk around and you think, oh, that looks nice. I quite like that. And you do that about four times and you come out of there with something that you take home, you have for dinner, and you think, that was nice. I enjoyed that. Worked really well for M&S Food, didn't it? Yeah. And Tesco had completely lost that. So he comes into this scenario and then very shortly afterwards, it not only emerges that it's all a bit of a mess, but they've been cooking the books. There's a sort of financialization of supermarket sales that goes on in terms of getting products in and when you pay your suppliers and where you put them on the shelves and bringing forward money from here and money from there. And yes, it turned out that there had been some serious cooking of the books, which did end up in a fraud trial, although I'm not sure whether anybody was ever found guilty there. So things went south very rapidly. Dave's reaction to this was to try and take control of the situation. There was a lot of kitchen sinking, as it's known in the business, where you basically lob everything bad you can possibly find into the pot. Every time Tesco's results came out, they would write down more money from this bad investment or that bad investment or this thing that had gone off. So you have these supposed one-off charges. It's actually a wonderful set of accounts to study if you want to become an investor or to study business results, because there is an argument that you should only consider one-off charges as one-off when they are one-off, whereas if a company delivers one-off charges, you know, results in, results out every 6 months, then you might start to think that these are no longer one-off charges. So there's a whole thing about underlying profits that companies love to quote, which sort of takes into the one-off charge and makes their figures look better. But He's dragged the share price up 40% in the time that he's been there. At one point, it sank as low as about 140p. It's knocking around the £2.50 mark at the moment. That's still nowhere near the near £5 it reached at one point. The dividend's been cut a couple of times. The supermarkets have been suffering. There's been the rise of Aldi and Lidl. And Dave's moving on. My work here is done, he pretty much said the other day.
So that's he's basically said, I've taken this as far as I can.
Yeah, yeah, it's, I've done it. Someone else is coming in. We've got Ken from Boots. There are a number of large investors who have said your work here is not done because you took over Booker, which is the kind of wholesaler, and that hasn't been merged into the business yet. And they're like, you should have finished that through. His legacy will be that he dragged Tesco back up to the point where when you walk into the shop, you now do find lots of things that you'd quite like to eat. Mm-hmm. And Tesco's food's pretty good now. It's much less of a mess than it used to be. The wine is very good, actually. If you look for the Tesco finest stuff, they've got some really good wine buyers. And you mentioned football managers. And the one thing that Dave has also managed to do while he's been at Tesco is be paid an astonishing amount of money. I saw a figure the other day that I can't verify whilst we're talking now, but I believe he's picked up around about £20 million in the time that he's been here. Last year, he got £4.6 million. His basic was £1.25 million, and the rest was bonuses and incentives. And all of that kitchen sinking back in the day has certainly helped with those bonuses and incentives. Because if there's one thing that makes you look good in the future, it's when everything looks really, really bad in the past. So, you know, well done, Dave. But their pre-tax profits were up 4% in their six-month results. And just as a little mark of how difficult the supermarket retail business is, they made £494 million of pre-tax profit in that six-month period. They had to sell £28.3 billion worth of stuff to make that money. That's an awful lot of stuff to make not a particularly big profit. The margins in retail are wafer thin, and that is why supermarkets and retailers are always at the mercy of fate.
So before we get on to the challenges that await his successor, you spoke about Mr. Lewis having a lot of money. As someone who is an expert in investing, Simon, and you look at companies like this, and I assume you look at the people at the top very closely, money well spent?
On Dave Lewis?
Mm-hmm.
I think CEO pay is ridiculous, personally. I think that the pay of the executive class is completely out of hand. I think that there is a very strong argument for trying to do something more about it. I don't think shareholders hold bosses to account enough. I think too much of it is structured in terms of what they manage to do to the share price, which encourages short-term thinking. This is not directly, you know, related to Dave Lewis. This is just in general. And I think that there is an idea about there should be a ratio, maximum ratio between the median worker and the highest paid person in the company. Mm-hmm. I think there is some merit in that. It drags up if the boss wants to be paid a load of money, it drags up the median worker. Labour's got this plan about taking 10% of shares off companies and giving them to employees. Companies don't actually own their own shares. Individuals own their shares. And you are basically appropriating other people's assets if you do that. I've put forward this idea before that what you should do is you combine the two things. And basically, if you award shares to anybody in the company, there is a ratio to them and the median worker. And it means that if your boss is picking up £4 million worth of shares or £3 million worth of shares, then there's a 50-to-1 ratio. And therefore, the median worker has to pick up the same amount of shares. And all of a sudden, that would benefit the workers because it should drag them up. And it might also limit what the bosses are taking.
That's good when the company's doing well, but one of the things that you have to say to staff if they're going to invest in their own company is that they're putting too many eggs in one basket. You know, you're getting paid by a company. If they go out of business, you might lose your job and your shares will go down and you don't have a salary anymore. So I've always been a bit sceptical of employee share plans for that reason.
Tanya's right there, actually, because what you do need to do is if you do give employees shares in their own companies, you need to warn them not to put all their eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And we have a very good example of that that we can hold up to teach people about it, which is RBS and HBOS and the financial crisis, where lots of the people who were hardest hit were actually their own staff, who lots of whom lost their jobs and had most of their savings tied up in shares that absolutely nosedived.
All right, but Ken?
He's an unknown quantity, but the problems aren't going to change. Supermarkets are an absolutely fascinating business, and it's one of those things where, because we all use them, we've all got an opinion on them. And, you know, whether they should put the chocolate bars near the tills or not. It's a really cutthroat industry as well, which also makes it really interesting. There's always price wars looming. We've got Amazon on the horizon as well, maybe not even on the horizon, coming over the horizon. Mm. Although Drastic Dave managed to pull back from some of the expansion plans, they did launch a Jack's store. There's apparently been one closure in that, so it may well be that they've gone down the wrong road on that again. There's also this ongoing problem with, like, how many supermarkets do you need in terms of space when people are doing so much online? I think there's bound to be closures and a rethink about what you do with all of that floor space. So there's a lot to think about. It's going to be interesting no matter what.
Simon, talking about cycles. We're not going to talk about cycles at all. We're going to talk about motors. Not motorcycles either. Cars. Cinderella ones. The rags to the riches. The cheapo cars you can get now that experts reckon could become classics worth a lot more in the future. It just sounds like something that you'd tell your other half. Darling, don't worry about it. It's going to be worth something in the future. Can we have a new car? No, this will be worth something in the future. Simon, what have we got?
Man maths, as it's known. We'll make money on this. It won't cost us money. No. You think it's old and unreliable, but this, it won't depreciate. This will go up in value. You see, whereas if we buy that new car, that's guaranteed to lose a third of its value in the first 3 years. And even if we buy that three-year-old car, yes, you think it's going to be more reliable. But once you factor in the depreciation, you're better off buying this old car, future classic, going to go up in value. It's free motoring.
However, you reckon...
Yes, so if you're like Dave Lewis and you've got a lot of time on your hands and a lot of money, then you probably don't need to buy one of these. But if you're like Dave Lewis and if you're not like Dave Lewis and you've got a little bit of time on your hands but not so much money, then you might not want to go out and spend the £50,000 that an E-Type's going to cost you, but you might still like a classic car. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's really moving, or has been really moving in the last few years, is modern classics. It's basically the cars of yesteryear that suddenly start to become rare and suddenly start to become worth something. And you'd be surprised if you go to a classic car show, the stuff that people go and look at. Mm-hmm. You'll find lots of people who go look at the Ferrari. But I tell you what, if there's an Austin Allegro there, you'll find loads of people walking around looking at that as well. And it's all that, oh, I used to have one of those, or my dad used to have one of those, or my mate had one of those, or I always wanted one of those. And so what you want is the cars that stand out a bit and are a bit special. And so we've got 10 cars here, tipped for future classic status, and then Rob Hull, our motoring reporter, has given them his modern classic likelihood score out of 5.
Okay.
So first up, Peugeot 306 GTI6. This was considered the spiritual successor to the Peugeot 205 GTI, which was the famous hot hatch of the 80s. Decent ones can be found for about £1,000. I'm not so sure. You probably need to spend more than £1,000. It's not a 205 GTI, but it's seen as probably the next best thing. Mm. If you buy one of these, it probably will go up in value. Modern classic likelihood, 5 out of 5. Audi A2. Bit of a little space age Audi, this was. Very much ahead of its time. People like them. 4 out of 5 likelihood. Alfa Romeo 159 Sport Wagon. That's an estate car. Probably very pretty car. Probably one of the best looking estate cars ever made. Likelihood of being a future classic, only 2 out of 5. Yeah. Lot of diesels, not really that much, you know, love for them. MGF, little MG sports car, tried to revive the sort of MGs of the past, but done in the sort of 2000s. There's a following for them, and they're a great little car, but there was a lot of them around, 3 out of 5. VW Beetle, not the classic Herbie one, the one that was reborn, has now been killed off. If you get one of these and you get it with a special edition V5 engine, maybe a bit of chance. Classic likelihood, 3 out of 5. Fiat Coupe, 5 out of 5 for these. Very angular, very popular. If you can find a good one, 25 when, turbo, buy
when
it.
You're talking about a raise money, and that's a good example. We're not going to go through all of them, but you know what are we talking about here? Like,
well, I mean, so, right. So look, if you buy one of, so it's all relative, isn't it? So if you buy a Peugeot 306 GTI 6 and you spend £1,500 on it, then you might find that it's probably always going to be worth at least £1,500 because they're getting rarer. They're not making any more of them. Mm. They are popular. They do have a following from back in the day. And you might find in 5 years' time it's worth more money. But we're talking about it might be worth £3,000. So that's...
It's not to be stiff, that.
Well, you doubled your money, haven't you? Whereas most cars lose money. So it's that kind of thing. So it's, you know, you can't bet on classic cars making loads of money. If you want a classic car, buy one to drive it. You know, buy it for the enjoyment. And if it goes up in value, then you've done well and you got lucky. And it probably just won't fall in value. I mean, what you are seeing, though, at the top of the market is the really expensive classic cars. Valuations have fallen. They're selling for less money. And that's just an example of how you are not guaranteed to make money. People kid themselves that you're guaranteed to make money on cars. You're not. If you'd have bought a Ferrari Testarossa maybe a year and a half ago, then it's quite likely it might be worth less money now. But then probably if you'd bought Ferrari Testarossa a year and a half ago, you wouldn't want to sell it now anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, exactly, exactly. All right, well, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you'd like to get in contact with us, perhaps you've got another classic car that you've got recommendation.
Yes, you can. Well, you can comment on the podcast at thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or if you've got a problem that you'd like us to investigate, then email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.